I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. One of the continuously surprising things about doing this interview program is that from time to time you get to talk to people you've long been a fan of, people you've been listening to for years, watching or reading. David Byrne is one of those people. And one of the great bonuses has been getting to know David, on occasion having lunch with him. Over a recent meal, he told me about some travels he made this past summer, trips that revisited his past. Over 40 years ago now, David founded a residential treatment center for drug addicts, ex-cons, and alcoholics, the Ex-Calais Foundation. If you're like me and listen to David's radio program over the years, you've heard about it before, but the background is fascinating. And on a trip to Winnipeg some weeks ago, David gave a marvelous talk to the organization about its history. It's on YouTube, and we'll link to it on the website. If you get a chance to watch the video, it's about an hour or so, but well worth it. I've asked David on today to talk about this part of his vast and varied life, to talk about drug addictions. And in his previous appearances, we've talked politics, but this time something different and I hope useful. In his last appearance in May, we talked about the suspending of his blog, which I'm glad is now back. David's posting frequently, and they're great reads. The blog is at theburnermonologues.blogspot.com, and his website is at davidburner.com. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, David Byrne. Good morning, Mr. Byrne.
Hi, Joe. Great to talk to you, as always.
So how did you get into the addictions treatment business, if that's the word for it?
Yeah, that's it. I was 23 years old. I was a taxi driver, and I was unhappy. I wasn't doing anything particularly useful. I didn't graduate from university, but I'd put in a few years, and I knew I was smart, and I knew I could do something. And, you know, making cash money, driving late night shifts for a yellow taxi really wasn't the answer. And a friend of mine, who turned out to be quite famous later, steered me in this direction. His name was Bob Hunter, and he was the founder of Greenpeace. But we were old buddies from Winnipeg, and he said, you should go see the Company of Young Canadians, which was unknown to me at the time, and it was a kind of domestic peace corps that Lester Pearson, the Prime Minister, had started. So I went and met this guy and named Jeff, and we hit it off, but he didn't really have anything going at the moment because he had just opened the office. So I went away, and I came back a few months later, and he said, okay, we've got some projects, and they need some help. And the Company of Young Canadians was, you know, like a Peace Corps. They'd take sort of white urban youth who had some education and put them into situations where they might be of some help to people who were struggling with poverty or mental health issues or political problems or any form of disempowerment or disenfranchisement. We have a lot of that in Canada. So I looked at these projects, and I thought that three of the four of them were kind of nonsense, but I was drawn for some curiosity to this one about Native Indians in the BC penitentiary. So we went and met these guys, and we had a kind of confrontation because they told us all about this halfway house idea they had, and I said, well, it's all very dreamy, but you don't seem to have any concrete ideas about how to pull us off. I'm giving you a lighter, more pleasant version of how the argument really went. But I was impressed with them, and I was impressed with their idea, and I just knew that I had to move on and do something. So I told this man, Jeff, that I would volunteer for 2 years. And he, in fact, signed me up not as a volunteer but as a staff person because he wanted to use me for some other things as well. So I began. And in January 1967, I started by meeting a guy at the penitentiary who was being released, and we went looking for a house to rent. We had no idea what we were doing. We were just making this up as we were going along. And we made one colossal error after another. I mean, on the very first day, I had this fellow Richard in tow with me, and I first we knocked on the door of a house wanting to rent it, and the woman said, what do you want to rent it for? And I stupidly told her the truth. I said, we want a sort of halfway house for Indian ex-cons, and of course she slammed the door in our face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then Then, running out of energy, I took Richard to the Balmoral for a beer, which wasn't the brightest idea. By now, I was all of 24 years old, so I was very wise indeed. And Richard almost got into a fist fight with somebody, and I had to grab him by the arm and say, "Sit down, you just got out of prison, are you crazy?" Not realizing, of course, that he was crazy.
Yeah.
Turns out he was a killer, and I really didn't pay much attention to that. Anyway, so within about a month and a half, he and another guy and I rented a little house in a bungalow just off McDonald on West Fifth Avenue, and we started this experiment, and we stumbled from one error to another, no rules, no concept of how we were going to shape this, but meanwhile, more people kept moving in, and pretty soon we outgrew the little house, so we moved into another house with Native Indian girls, and we had this full melodrama going. It was very funny. And toward the end of the first year, Joe, we realized that a simple principle that we couldn't do this on rented premises, that we had to own something. And so we called a halt for a month or so, and then Jeff, the fellow for the Company of Young Canadians, found us some money from Van City, which has always been an extraordinarily progressive and socially conscious institution, especially for a bank. And they gave us a little bit of money. We bought a house in Fairview Slopes, which would now cost a fortune. But we bought that house, and we had an option on the house next door, and we bought the house next door. And then we started to get a shape to what we were doing, and we started letting in some heroin addicts. And before we knew it, we had a real program, and we also had lots and lots of junkies and other kinds of addicts, but mostly heroin addicts. And the program had two basic rules. They were, and still are to this day, no drugs, chemicals of any kind, anywhere, anytime, as long as you're part of the organization. You can't have a beer on the street. You can't have a toke of weed. If you want an aspirin, you'll have to ask for it, and so on. Zero tolerance, and no violence or threats of violence. And break either of those rules and you're gone, and you can try again next time. When I was in Winnipeg in August, I spoke to many people, but one of the guys I spoke to is a 6'4" guy, and I said, "Tell me your story." And he said, "Well, this is my fifth try." So while the organization doesn't put up with nonsense, it's forgiving and people can try again. But it's very clear if you break those rules, you're gone. Anyway, the program started to develop and became very complicated, Joe. Pretty soon we had sold those two houses in 1970 or 1969 and bought a mansion in Lower Shaughnessy. And before we knew it, we had about 40 people in residence, and we were owning and operating a Shell gas station and a beauty park and a pen advertising company and a pizza restaurant. And by the fourth year, we had 125 people in residence and a full-blown program of group therapy every night and school speaking programs, and we played touch football every weekend, and we went swimming, and we played bridge, and the logo on our letterhead and our business cards showed a black square within, or was it a black circle? A black circle within a larger gold square, and the slogan was a community within a community. And we were the first what is called therapeutic community in Canada. There are now not many of them, but several of them. Portage from Quebec has moved recently to British Columbia to help people in the Carameas area. Lord Maincourt, the former city councilor and MLA, has opened a therapeutic community model up in Prince George. John Volkin, the multimillionaire who used to own United Furniture, has successfully opened Welcome Home in Surrey, thanks to the mayor, Diane Watts. So there are others, but they're not many, and in my opinion, they're hardly enough. We need more.
Now, I'm interested about the actual rules in the house. So you said there's no drugs, no violence.
Yeah.
Now, it's not you. If you live there, if you're a client, I don't know if that's the right word.
Yeah, resident client.
Resident client. You live there. You're given a room, board, a meal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to work at the gas station or at the pizza place or?
No, well, today in Manitoba, the Ex-Calais Foundation is renamed, by the way. It's called the Behavioral Health Foundation, and people can look it up at www.bhf.ca. They don't operate businesses like this anymore, but in those days, no, not only did you not have to, we couldn't possibly employ all the people we had. Most of the people in the program for the first 3 to 6 months are in program 29 hours a day. In other words, we didn't encourage people within the first 3 months or 6 months to go find a job, because it takes people, you know, their whole lives to screw up. It takes you years and years to become a good solid addict, and although it takes a minute, but it takes years, and you don't suddenly become clean in 28 days. There are lots of for-profit organizations that charge considerable amounts of money for 20-day programs, and I don't want to be crude and say they're laughable, but I just don't put much stock in them. You cannot change a lifetime of behavior in 28 days. So no, people, you know, were not encouraged to go out to school and out to work within the first few months.
Now, there were incidences of violence in the home?
No, not once we established those rules. There had been incidents long before we ever got really organized. We had a couple of very serious Donnybrooks in the first year when we had no rules. I mentioned that the first guy I ever worked with was a killer. He had been doing federal time for killing a guy in a knife fight, and when he was sober, he was a lovely guy, interesting, intelligent, thoughtful. And when he was drunk, he was a lunatic. He was just a wild, out-of-control lunatic and liked knives. So, you know, we had a couple of very scary incidents, and it became very clear to us that we could tolerate neither violence nor threats of violence. And I have to tell you that once those rules were established, no one ever came remotely close to challenging them.
Now, why is it that this worked and other things? You mentioned earlier that some of the other programs are laughable. Why did this work?
Oh, there's lots of reasons, but let's start with a basic, Joe. First of all, our interest and our concern and our approach had nothing to do with alcohol or drugs. In other words, to us, when I say us, people running a program like this, the therapeutic community model, we're not in the least bit interested in your choice of poison. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter if you're a crack addict or whatever you ingest or shove up your nose or whatever. That's completely irrelevant. The disease, the problem, the issue is loneliness and stupidity. It's an issue of not being able to cope with all of the other hardships that all other human beings deal with every day to one degree of success or another. Everybody has to deal with the fact that we come into the world alone, we leave it alone. If we have some meager success, we make friends, we have lovers, we get married, we have kids, we respect our parents, we buy tickets to the Canucks, to the opera, we have a library card, we go to the community center to work out, and so on. Addicts don't do any of those things. Addicts do one thing. They dope fiends shoot dope. That's what they do. That's their entire absorption. Alcoholics do one thing. They drink. That's what they do. They have no other interest. Zero. None. So, number one, we never talk about that stuff. It's pointless. What the engagement is about, what we're always talking about in the therapeutic community, is other stuff, is books, is music, is your family, is your heart and soul, your work, what you did today, what you're doing tomorrow, what you thought of that movie, how good are you at being a running back in the touch football game. and so on. In other words, we're engaging people in the realities of life, and we're not wasting our time with garbage. So that's number one. You can't, in most 28-day programs, in so many so-called programs, they actually have classes on alcohol. They have classes on heroin, how heroin affects you. This is irrelevant shit. Pardon my language. I'm sorry.
It's just
irrelevant nonsense. Yeah. You know? Everybody knows it's bad. That's all you need to know. You don't need to understand MS-DOS to run a computer, and you don't need to know how alcohol or heroin affects the inner organs of your body. All you have to know is that it's bad for you if you're one of those people. So that's number one. Number two, what people are getting in a therapeutic community is what they need, and this is what it is. They're getting two things. They're getting all day long, they're getting love and support, they're getting people patting them on the back and saying, hey, that was great, loved what you did today, good for you. They're being thanked for doing good things, they're being thanked for being decent people, they're being congratulated for having another clean day, and so on. And simultaneously, or alternately, they're being kicked in the butt for doing something stupid, which invariably they will do. So they're getting, it's really like when people come into the program, it's like treating someone who's 5 years old, even if they're 35. Because emotionally, that's who they are. Psychologically, they are 5 years old. And they need a tight, serious structure that says, here's the rules, we love you for being you, and we're going to kick your ass every time you make some stupid, boneheaded mistake. And slowly, with this buoyancy of love and support and this constant sort of picking away at your stupidities, you're going to grow up. You can't do that, Joe, in 28 days. There just isn't enough time, there's not enough energy, and there's not enough complexity in those environments because they'll have, 20, 30 resident clients in that kind of a program, or if it's worse than that, a lot of programs, of course, are just day programs. And all they can offer is counseling, and that's better than nothing, I guess. Love to see any kind of treatment that's going to help. But counseling is just talk. It's not action. It's just not enough. So the therapeutic community has a lot of people in it. You know, the one that so many people talk so much about, San Patrignano in Italy, north of Venice, has 1,500 people in it. It's a rural setup, and it's a kind of farm, and people work there and so on. It's very complicated. Synanon, the granddaddy of all the therapeutic communities models in California, which no longer exists but has many, many spin-offs which still thrive, Daytop Center and Phoenix Houses and so on, Synanon in its heyday had way over 500 people at any given time. I think if I recall correctly, the Santa Monica Hotel facility on the beach in Los Angeles had 500 people at any moment. We had 125 in Vancouver, and in 71 when we opened Winnipeg, within a matter of months, we had over 100 there. And today, the Behavioral Health Foundation has over 100.
And the program still exists here in Vancouver?
No, it doesn't.
How long were you with it?
10 years.
After 10 years, why did you leave it?
I couldn't do the work anymore. I ate, slept, and breathed it 29 hours a day, 12 days a week. It consumed me. I was dedicated to it. And then, to be blunt, I wasn't. I just lost the energy. I just couldn't do the work. I still, thought the work was important, but I guess I burned myself out, and I just didn't want to do this kind of activity anymore. So when I realized that, I realized it in a very specific moment. I realized it when I was walking through the hallway one day and a new possible resident client walked through the door, and I looked at this young guy and I thought to myself, oh my God, there's another 2 years of work. And my next thought was, that's a nice way to think, David. And I sat down in my office and I realized that I had a problem. And it took me a year and a half to extricate myself, So I stopped after 10 years.
So you go on, you have this illustrious career in broadcasting on the stage and so on and so forth. And a few weeks ago, I guess in July sometime, some woman contacts you on the email, right?
Well, it's not just some woman. It's Jean Duché, who's the executive director of the foundation today, and she sent me this mysterious and surprising, as it turned out, extraordinarily welcome email out of the blue saying, "Hi, David. You may not remember, but in 1976, I served you breakfast. And, you know, we'd love to see you, and do you ever come out this way," and so on. And the next thing I knew, I was in Winnipeg.
Yeah, and so you go there, and you see how the program's evolved.
Yeah.
You're obviously surprised at how it's turned out.
Well, I'm just overwhelmed with appreciation and gratitude for how beautifully it's continuing. Now, it has changed in some ways. You know, it's moved forward in many ways. We had one building that I originally signed off on in this location on the south end of Winnipeg near the University of Manitoba in a little village called St. Norbert, Manitoba. That building houses 100 people, and when I signed the papers on that in 1971, that was it. It's a 100-acre site right on the river. But now Jean has built, and others before her have built, a separate house for teenage girls, a separate building for adult education, several buildings for Aboriginal culture, because 80% of her clients are Aboriginal. The community donated a full-size hockey rink. There are sweat lodges. I mean, it's an amazing facility. Plus, she has another a facility for teenage boys 50 miles up the road in Selkirk, Manitoba, and that's sitting on a huge acreage in a forest by the river. So physically, it's grown, and it's also grown intellectually. I mean, she's gotten accreditation from every organization in the world that recognizes the value of what they do. She's got a six-month waiting list. She's got a packed house. She's got a whole education department. She's turning out high school grads like crazy. She's getting people back into the workforce faster than we ever did. I mean, the program has really grown up in a lot of ways while maintaining all of the basics.
And you must be gratified by all this.
Gratified.
I mean, you leave it for a number of years, and then it comes back into your life. I mean, how does that feel?
Well, I'll tell you how it feels. I'll tell you the story. I'll illustrate it. Jean was showing me around the property the first day, and we were walking towards the Aboriginal cultural buildings and to have a look at the sweat lodges and so on. And a young boy walked past us. And he sort of stopped, like he wanted to say hello or something. So I stopped, and I said hi. And when we were talking to him, I thought he was 14. He looked like a little kid. It turns out he's 18 years old. And I said, "Hi, what's your name?" And he said, "James." And I said, "Hi, James, how long have you been here?" And he said, 2 months. And I said, "So, what do you think?" And he just had this huge beaming smile, and he said, "Oh, I love it." And I said, "Really?" I was actually kind of taken aback by that, and I said, "Really? Why?" And he said, "I feel safe here." And I couldn't talk for a minute, you know. And I said, "Well, that's great." And I turned around and tried to talk to Jean, and I couldn't really speak because I'm sort of overwhelmed by this, the fact that so many years ago I did some little thing, and it's continued and continued and continued, and it's bringing positive effect to a kid who wasn't even born yet, you know. And it's more than gratifying. It's kind of it's beautiful and astonishing. I think it's so wonderful.
You know, David, it's been good talking to you again, but I mean, you know, just listening about how this all began and what it means to you, I think, is in hearing, you know, how it's affecting you and the sort. I mean, it's just a great thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Joe. You know, you have to put it in context. What Gene is doing and what a handful of other people across the country are doing and around the world are doing is they're running. And by the way, I must tell you, there's a therapeutic community model inside a prison in Nanaimo Regional Correctional Institution. And the warden there, Don Moody, is just an extraordinarily enlightened guy. And he brought me there also this summer to see what they were doing. And so much of what they were doing was an extension of what we had created 40 years ago. So there are people like Don Moody and the gal who runs the John Howard in Nanaimo, Franz Tellier, who's building some small therapeutic community modeled houses, Jean Duché in Winnipeg, people across the country are turning out clean and sober citizens. And put that in the larger context where so many so-called experts, mayors and officials, they're celebrating places for addicts to shoot up, they're celebrating free needles, they're championing now the public health officer, the provincial health officer, Dr. Perry Kendall, is saying we should have clean, safe, crack smoking rooms and so on. All of these people seem dedicated to maintaining the madness, all in the name of harm reduction, which I call harm seduction and Gene calls harm production. Here we have some really dedicated people like Gene and Don Moody and others, you know, saying, wait a minute, we can turn out clean and sober citizens. It just takes a bit of work. And all the officials say, no, we want a silver bullet. We want a quick answer. We want to give people things to so that they'll stop breaking into our cars. It's not only immoral and ugly, it's totally ineffective. It cannot work because the guy who smokes up at your safe crack smoking room at 10 o'clock will smoke up in his usual haunt or in the back alley at 3:30 because dope fiends shoot dope. That's what they do. And you know, one so-called safe fix a day is not going to cut it. So that's why it's especially gratifying to see, to visit behavioral health in Winnipeg and see that this work that I started, not knowing what I was doing, not having a plan, just sort of falling into it and then just working at it day after day, making mistakes, learning from the mistakes, learning from wonderful mentors and advisors who surrounded me, to see this continuing and bringing about good in the world. Look, I have several rabbi friends, and two of them have told me in the recent years, there's an old saying, if you save one soul, you save the universe. Well, people like Jean are saving souls every day. She's got over a million clean man days chalked up. So I'm very proud of it. And for all of it, I've interviewed celebrities and you know, prime ministers and movie stars, and I've acted in movies, and I've had all this fun in my life. It's all lovely, but doesn't hold a candle to what we've been talking about today.
You know, for your small part, David, congratulations and God bless you for it.
Thanks.
I appreciate your time today, David, and we'll talk again.
Sure. Cheers. Thanks, Joe.
You're very welcome. The website, davidbrunner.com, of course. Read the blog, thebrunnermonologues.blogspot.com. David Brunner on the line. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planner.